The views expressed on this podcast are the views of the host and guest, and not necessarily representative of the views of Twin Focus. The information presented on this podcast should not be construed as investment advice.
Welcome to World in Focus. I'm your host, Jeff Eisler. Our guest today is Chuck Storman, a 7-time serial entrepreneur and prominent figure in the fields of artificial intelligence and venture capital. Chuck left his PhD studies to found Coherent Research, which commercialized chip architecture for neural networks. He then co-founded Coherent Networks, which combined neural networks and expert systems in one of the first commercially successful hybrid AI solutions, which transformed the electric utility industry. He then founded Stellius, a real-time performance management company that supplied network-related intelligence to telecom operators. Chuck is now pivoted to venture capital while continuing to be an entrepreneur, operator, in a series of businesses. In what is planned to be the first in a series of conversations, we cover a little history and outline key topics for understanding where AI is and where it may be going. Enjoy. The question this morning really is to set the stage. AI is this time different. The introduction of ChatGPT kind of pushed AI back into the consciousness of a broad audience. But AI is not new. The term was coined in 1956, and it's been kind of interesting. The recent announcement has echoed prior interest in AI. So I thought it'd be interesting to provide a little context and set the stage. So where I'd like to start is that what really I found interesting is when the announcement came out, there was a flurry of articles on both sides, both dystopian and utopian visions of what AI would do to the world. I just, Chuck, thought we could start it out with saying, why do you think that is? Maybe a little context from your side, from someone who's been in the field for quite some time.
Thanks, Jeff. It's a really great question. I think that AI tends to invoke a strong response when people come in contact with it for the first time. There's amazement, there's fear, there's all kinds of reactions to it. So it's kind of like AI is acting like a Rorschach test. If you're ultimately a pessimist, you might be viewing AI as something that will replace human workers and maybe look at it as a, something that will use its intelligence to take over the world. You know, it can be kind of an extreme reaction. If you're an optimist, then you see promise in it. You see the AI helping us find new biological molecules, cures for cancer, cures for all diseases, a solution to world hunger, nuclear fusion, unlimited clean energy. So, you know, basically the famous reviewers fall into these two camps. Guys like Jan LeCun and Reid Hoffman and Bill Gates, who are optimists and look at a very positive future view. And then you've got folks like Leopold Aschenbrenner or anybody that makes an action movie, you know, like The Terminator or The Matrix, are looking at AI as a job killer and a misinformation engine and ultimately an existential threat to human survival. So my view, since you're chatting with me, is that the glass is neither half empty nor half full. In fact, glasses are refillable. So I like to look at it as a realistically, AI is going to be used for all kinds of great things and all kinds of awful things. In the Industrial Revolution, we had a complete transformation of our society and opportunities and issues. We also had child labor and black lung disease. So, you know, these things take time. Humanity's great at adapting. And I think we will take this in stride, but there will be a lot of disruption and upheavals.
Yeah. If I'm reminded, going back even to the 20s, right? Ruhr and Metropolis were kind of all about, you know, the early robotics and the fear of, you know, what that meant.
Stanislaw Lem. I mean, 1920s. amazing how long we've been dreaming about and building to the best extent we can automatons to simulate life. Yeah. Back to the original Mechanical Turk, this robot here to appear to do things. It actually had a little man inside the box, but moving the levers around. But nowadays, we've actually got quite a long way towards building helpers and autonomous agents that can do things while we rest.
Yeah. So from there, so maybe I thought before we dive in, I wanted to actually start with a really basic question. You mentioned replacing people. What is the goal of AI? I mean, and how has that evolved with the technology over time? Because I think helps level set and say, well, maybe the reality will be somewhere between the extremes, but maybe we start there, and I think that'll provide some context as we move forward.
Well, I think if you're like most of us, you love the idea of AI replacing tedious and repetitive work. So, whenever I'm driving, I use the self-driving feature in my car. It's definitely not perfect, but I use it like I would use cruise control just to take some of the effort out of long drives. And I think we can look at the same thing with AI assistants doing all kinds of repetitive and tedious work for us. I think that longer term, you could look at AI as a tool to augment our cognitive powers and give you the ability to process more data or generate more insights than you could without it. Mm-hmm. And then, in the long term, I think you can see that the machines that we're building don't just augment human thinking, but they will actually exceed us, just the way a chess program beat the world chess grandmaster in the late 90s. We will have access to specialized AIs that are able to do things that no individual human can do, and it will extend our capabilities just like air travel is better than walking. So I don't necessarily see that replacing humans, because in effect, it's going to create great productivity gains. And the Jevons paradox, when things get less expensive, the demand goes up. So I think we're actually going to see the need for more workers collaborating with AIs. It should create something of a boom.
All right. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting segmentation, replacing the tedious, expanding human intelligence, and then potentially exceeding. So where are we today then? I mean, and that's kind of a continuum potentially of where we are, where we're going. Where would you place us right now, or where would you place AI and its ability across that spectrum?
Well, very topically breaking news just in the last day or so, OpenAI announced that their ChatGPT 4.5 passed the Turing test. And if you remember the Turing, Alan Turing, who was part of the code breakers that helped us help the Allies win the Second World War, developed a lot of the ideas around AI. And the idea of the Turing test was, if you can get a machine that can fool humans into thinking it's a human, then it could be considered to be intelligent. So ChatGPT 4.5 was able to convince 73% of humans that it was, and that it was indeed another human on the other end of the chat. And most humans will rate other humans to be a human about 60-70% of the time. So so that's one milestone. But there are all these ideas of artificial general intelligence, artificial super intelligence that go beyond human capabilities. And, we're just starting to scratch the surface or see the tip of the iceberg on that. I think it's still very, very early days. in terms of AIs exceeding human capabilities. I think what you can see right now, anybody who's interacted with any of the large language models, they do exceed human intelligence in the sense that you can ask them a question about any topic, and because they've been trained on all the books and all the web pages that are available electronically, no individual human has that broad of a knowledge base. And so already you can see sort of superhuman breadth in the capabilities of these LLMs. I think what we're looking forward to in the future is, across the board, some superhuman depth, so that, for example, the AI that's been trained to diagnose cancers of a particular type will do a more accurate and more reliable and more repeatable job than any individual doctor. But that doesn't mean that you don't want a doctor to interact with you. It's just that this AI is a great diagnostic tool, for example.
Right. And then a couple questions there. I mean, it kind of gets into the learning environment, which we'll talk about in the future. But I want to go back. The Turing test I always find very interesting, because you now have the risk of deep fakes. You've got the ability to create your own AI voice to, like, there's articles now, you can go out to the article and the article is being read to you by essentially an AI that is recreating the voice of the author. Mm-hmm. So you can listen to the podcast rather than have to read it, or you can listen rather than read. So maybe a little bit about the Turing test. What is it that has improved? Is it the voice synthesis, the syntax? Because there was the early AIs back in the 60s, right, were kind of like basically mirroring software, which would just take what you told it and kind of give it back to you. And this is kind of, these were text driven. So there was always that. So there wasn't a lot of depth that you could finally figure out that this person wasn't actually interacting with you. So where has the gains been? Is it purely the language synthesizing the syntax, or is it kind of the depth of the conversation? It's able to, we can get into the idea of the breath, kind of expand the conversation rather than kind of be like the bad analyst who said, so how do you feel about that? So tell me more.
Yeah, the talking about the ELIZA program,
right?
Exactly. That came out back in the 70s, and you know, even though it was only saying, oh, so I saw you mentioned your mother, tell me more about your mother, you know, it would really just feed things back in a question form. People would talk to it for hours,
right?
Because they, as long as they had the illusion that there was something listening to them, they just wanted to be heard. And but if you ever question, well, is that a therapist on the other end of this text, or is it actually just automated? You can very, very quickly discover. If, for instance, if you ask the therapist a question, ELIZA would just come back and you know, and it would have one of five ways of deflecting your question. Well, this isn't really about me; it's about you. So it was very, very shallow. I think what you see today is the large language models are so much larger, and they're trained so much more extensively that they can converse at a pretty deep level. You're never running into a canned response. You're always getting something that's being generated. The AI is in effect mirroring the intelligence of, you know, an artificial brain, and it's been trained on all of the knowledge and data that we've expressed in all of our humanity with all of our writing. So it's basically standing on the shoulders of humankind as giants. Mm-hmm. And it's just a whole different game than what we had in the 70s, and that's really because of the expansion of these models to be, you know, much more close in their complexity to what a biological brain has in its complexity.
Mm-hmm. Is it the ability to make just that many more connections? Is this kind of just a simple question that the models themselves are somewhat the same? You know, I'm familiar with neural nets and genetic algorithms from back in the day. Is it just the breadth and the scale of compute and the ability to take in just that much more data that has pushed this out, or have the models themselves added a layer of, you know, say neural density, which would be more of a scale issue, or is there something else emerging within the models, you know, as you reach that threshold? What do you think is pushing that? Because right now, if you use an LLM, it's like having a new but very eager, tireless research assistant. They'll find you everything, but not really put anything into context.
Yeah, absolutely. And they seem to me, when I interact with these LLMs, they seem to me to be hovering around a 120 IQ. as I've interacted with people, you know, that's kind of just a generalization. But what is it? It's funny that the algorithms for neural networks have not changed that much. I started in the field in 1984. And at the time, we could only build really small neural networks because of the memory constraints and the amount of computing that was required to train and to update and to use the model. But the techniques that we're using today are extremely recognizable. Anybody from the 1950s would understand, anyone who was in the field in the 1950s would understand, oh, look, we're using a perceptron. It's a lot more than what we had then, a lot more of them. Some of the new things that have been found to be effective recently date back a long, long way. So reinforcement learning is basically the idea that you give the network a task, you set it some goals, and you give it some rewards if it achieves the goals as it approaches better and better goal-seeking behavior. And then you just let it run repetitiously and try again, try every possible thing. You've seen examples of this when they're using a simulation of a robot, trying to teach it to walk, and it, you know, it doesn't get a rule about how to move all of its motors and actuators to walk properly. It just keeps trying and failing until it reaches some level of competence by experimentation. You see the same thing in the networks they're training for playing games like chess or Go. They give it the rules of the game and they set up the board and have it play itself in a simulation until it becomes unbeatable. So these are the same basic techniques that we have been developing for 60 years. What is different now is that, you know, it used to be a debate, will this ever work? And at some point around 2017, we began to see really, really fascinating results and behaviors emerge from these larger networks that at a certain size, you go up a factor of 10 and all of a sudden it can do a lot more than you expected it could. And it's happened in a way of discovery. It's been very surprising to us in the field. So ChatGPT, when it was released in late 2022, was a breakthrough, but again, it was a breakthrough that was many, many decades in the making.
So maybe we can, saying it that way, it sounds like, you know, having been through a number of cycles and then a lot of things occur like this, there's that initial enthusiasm and sense of promise, potentially overpromise, and that's just not a financial market thing, but in terms of all of the things that AI can do, and, you know, being in finance, you see that reflected in market prices. And then they get ahead of themselves, and there's essentially a little bit of a sense of under delivery. So it makes it sound like, so if the underlying models are somewhat similar and it's really just been a question of scale and breadth, does that become somewhat problematic in terms of, you know, how much compute can there be given the constraints on energy, how much training can there be, and we can, you know, foreshadowing a little bit where we'll go in the future, how much data is there, is there more to it than that, and how do, you know, is this time different, and you know, what will be different that kind of leads us out of, you know, because having looked at neural nets and genetic algorithms, they kind of didn't quite lead where we thought they would, and they kind of have kind of went back to the back burner again, and now have reemerged. So, you know, will this time be different? And, you know, what will, if so, why?
That's great question, Jeff. You know, as I've, I think what's important for us all to remember is that there have been really good practical applications of AI throughout its history. In the 90s, we built an AI system that helped the electric utilities get their electric grid model online. And it cut about 400 person years off of the task. It was tremendously successful, and it used neural networks. Back then, there were limited things we could do. But if, as long as we kept in mind what the constraints were and kept our designs within scope, we could build very effective systems. And the same thing's true today. I think what's different today, and you know, I've seen AI go through hype cycles and winters many times. And that's because people lost sight of what the real constraints are. So what we have today are three ingredients that allow AI to have an impact at scale. We do have a lot of data, a lot of digitized data. It's only in the last decade that all the books ever written have been digitized and made available. And we've got a tremendous data lake of information that we can use for the world's largest training data set. We have easily a million times more compute power available. Today's computers have been following Moore's law, meaning power doubles at a constant dollar every 18 months, compute power. Same's true of memory. We have the ability to store models with trillions of parameters. And with these larger models and faster computers, we've seen capabilities emerge that were unexpected. And then the third element is we've got great business models. We've got companies that see clear paths to revenue building on applications of AI, unlike past projects that were more like science projects. You know, you can't really argue with ChatGPT having 500 million users, many of them not paying anything, but their revenues continue to grow. You know, it's a really unprecedented phenomena where what's different now with all of these infrastructure and abilities is that people are really noticing and using it every single day. So it's having a huge impact. And I think this will be the next industrial revolution.
What are the risks or the potential gating factors? What do you, you know, that is the promise. Where do you think the issues lie that have to be addressed to kind of see that or fulfill that vision going forward?
Sure. And you mentioned some of them already when you talked about deep fakes and misinformation. You know, it's having a very enthusiastic research assistant or a whole host of them can be used for good or ill. You know, if I set my mind to what's the best way to run a hoax, using AI will amplify that. And I think we need to make sure that we have tools available that allow us to recognize deepfakes. That's something, you know, I have a company in our portfolio that focuses entirely on that, that I have high hopes for, that basically tracks misinformation campaigns, figures out what narratives are being used to create what reactions, and develops counter narratives to try and take some of the wind out of the sails of the misinformation. And it also has a deep fake detector that will basically tell you, yeah, this video has been altered. So, you know, don't believe that the person you see doing that thing actually did that thing. Same thing with deep fakes of people's voices. You know, there are scams where person gets an urgent call from their son or daughter saying, you know, I really need you to send some money here right now. And it's actually just a scam, but, you know, it pulls at our heartstrings because it sounds exactly like our son or our daughter. So we need to have guardrails in place. We need to have laws in place. And we do have those tools and those legal frameworks to manage that. I think where we can put a little more thought is in regulatory frameworks, which I think are very difficult to get right and need a lot of experimentation. But beyond that, I think we are going to see on the plus side amazing productivity gains. And so this is going to advantage the companies that adopt these new capabilities to enhance productivity, make their businesses more profitable, and to help them grow faster.
Okay. Yeah. And then beyond the regulatory side, I mean, do you think there also needs to be you mentioned the Industrial Revolution, the transition of folks from one industry to the next or from one job to the next, and we can talk about it, but seems more job specific than industry specific to me.
I find it so interesting this time though, because we think of the first industrial revolution looking at someone who weaves to someone who operates a loom. Mm-hmm. You know, very different jobs, but some jobs didn't change that much. The design of the fabric may not change that much, just the means of producing it.
Right.
But with the new means of production, new designs became possible. And so the adaptability and creativity of human beings has been demonstrated at every technological revolution. You know, I don't think we evolved to drive cars at 70 miles an hour, but most of us don't have a problem actually performing that task that we never evolved to do. So there's a lot of adaptability in the biological brain. This transition's a little different because the AI can interact with you, and actually you can ask a large language model to train you for a new task. Say, hey, meet me where I am and teach me what I need to know to do this new thing I'm being asked to do. And it's like the thing that threatens to replace us can also become our tutor. Mm-hmm. And our coworker and our collaborator. So I think there are reasons to be hopeful. There's also the fact that a lot of people don't like change and don't want to change. And even if the tutor's available, they don't want to learn a new thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there will be some, therein lies some difficulty, I like to say. Because change is here and it's going to continue to be here. So, you know, resistance is futile. Might be one way of putting it.
Right. And in terms of then, do you think there is a useful regulatory or governmental response? Because knowing these transitions will occur, knowing that, you know, folks will have to adapt to it, is there You think there's anything that would be helpful in terms of the regulatory environment is very, very tricky. We can talk about that, but in terms of, you know, retraining and thinking about how folks do adapt, or, you know, do we leave it up to the individual just to kind of sort out on their own and say, hey, you know, go out and get an accountant and start asking questions. You know, what would you like to see to help kind of support that and ease that transition and make it productive for the individual?
Yeah, I personally think there's a productive role for government in this, by all means. And, you know, and there's no real huge innovation here. Those that are interested in learning, should be given educational opportunities. There should be support for that. There should be subsidies for retraining workers, as there always have been. And I think those that are displaced and can't make the transition, you know, it's good for us to have social safety nets, and it's good for us to have the ability as a very wealthy society to be kind and to be generous as people go through difficult transitions. How you turn that into government policy is way beyond my ken. I know that's sort of a very contentious and fraught area, and I'm more of a person that likes to get behind the right set of opportunities and push. You know, find really great young entrepreneurs and young companies, and be one of the early investors. So how the government has helped me in that task is by keeping capital gains tax rates low, and by having carried interest be treated nicely with tax, and also with qualified small business tax treatment, where gains on a qualified small business, as long as you hold the stock for 5 years, are completely tax-free. Those are things that I dearly love as a venture investor, and that have made it very lucrative for my partners and I, and our limited partners to back young companies that have a lot of inherent risk. But beyond that, I think we need some bright young political scientists to figure out the right regulatory regimes to help us make this transition.
Well, great. All right. So I'm going to sum that all up by saying you think this time will be different. And the areas for future conversations will be around the idea of differentiation across computing power, business models, and, as you know, my personal favorite, the data side of things. So why don't we wrap it up there. Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure, Jeff. Thank you so much yourself. And thanks for engaging in this great conversation.
Great. Looking forward to the next one. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.
This podcast is a medium for discussions and opinions. The views expressed by the host, contributors, and guests are their own and do not necessarily express the views, opinions, and official policies of Twin Focus and affiliated entities or companies. The investment ideas presented in this podcast are for informational and entertainment purposes only, and do not constitute and should not be construed as a recommendation by Twin Focus or its personnel to engage in investment activities. No investment recommendations or advice are provided in this podcast, nor should anything presented in this podcast be construed as investment advice and recommendations. This podcast may contain information on topics that include, without limitations, politics, finance, investments, health and medical, education, legal, or other professional fields and disciplines. Listeners are encouraged to seek independent qualified professional advice before making any investment decisions. Additionally, neither Twin Focus nor its personnel are under any obligation to provide ongoing monitoring and investment advice and recommendations on any ideas discussed in this podcast in which you have made subsequent investments. Any investment activity engaged by you in ideas discussed in this communication are voluntary and made at your own risk. Twin Focus, its hosts, guests, employees, owners, affiliates, or partners will not be liable for any direct, indirect, incidental, or consequential damages resulting from the use or misuse of information presented in the podcast under any circumstances in any jurisdiction. All content contained in this podcast is the intellectual property of Twin Focus and its affiliate entities or companies. Unauthorized use, reproduction, distribution, or modification of the podcast's content without explicit written permission of Twin Focus is strictly prohibited. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Different types of investments involve varying degrees of risk, and there can be no assurance that the future performance of any specific investment, investment strategy, or product, or any non-investment related content referenced directly or indirectly in this podcast will be profitable, equal to any historical performance, be suitable for your portfolio or individual situation, or prove successful. Due to various factors, including changing market conditions and/or applicable laws, the content may no longer be reflective of current opinions or positions. Moreover, you should not assume that any discussion or information contained in this podcast serves as the receipt of, or as a substitute for, personalized investment advice from Twin Focus. Twin Focus does not make any representation or warranties as to the accuracy, timeliness, suitability, reliability, completeness, or relevance of any information prepared by an unaffiliated third party and takes no responsibility for such content. This podcast may feature guest appearances and/or links to third-party websites and products. These references do not constitute endorsements, guarantees, opinions, and/or recommendations by Twin Focus and its affiliated entities or companies. We are not responsible for the content, policies, or practices of any third-party entities and websites referenced in the podcast.